All right, if you would find your way to the Old Testament book of Hosea. Hosea chapter 2. And as you're turning, I'll kind of remind you of or refresh your memories of the first chapter. First chapter is where we really got the setting of this book. The setting was a prophet by the name of Hosea, who was in the northern kingdom, sent to the northern kingdom. That's when the Israel as a whole was divided into the northern and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom consisted of those 10 tribes. And in those 10 tribes is where Jeroboam had set up those two shrines. You know, one in Dan, the northern part, and one in Bethel. You know, and they had set up that golden calf. You know, they were there worshiping the golden calves. They had their own feast days, their own holy days, their own fast. So these are the people. This is the godless society that Hosea is sent to preach to. Now, that's not saying the southern kingdom, Judah, was innocent. Judah was guilty of much of these same sins. And that's not saying that you are not guilty of many or most of these same sins. Amen. My point is, God is just addressing Israel in this passage, in this book. In here, the Lord instructs a man by the name of Hosea in chapter 2 to do this. Hosea, go take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom. Why? For the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. We're told what he is to do and why he is to do it. And it's not uncommon really for prophets in these days, and even in the New Testament, to act out their prophecies. You know, we can read in Ezekiel 4 where he lays on his side for 390 days to act out a prophecy. We're told in Acts 21, a prophet by the name of Agabus, you know, he takes the Apostle Paul's belt and he binds his hands and his feet and he says, so too will you be bound, Paul, if you return to Jerusalem. So it's not uncommon. And I know we know in the case of Ezekiel and we know in the case here that they're instructed by the Lord to do these things. So Hosea takes a wife of whoredom and has children of whoredom. He's actually a living picture of a present day reality in northern Israel of that time. And this wife is extremely unfaithful. Strays, chases other lovers, just completely unfaithful to Hosea. And so as we titled this message, I could only think of the song, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places. That would be Hosea's wife. And I know it's common for us to read this again and to read it as an exercise and you just, it's no big deal. Who cares? You know, it's just some Middle Eastern unfaithful wife being unfaithful to a Middle Eastern Jew. But what if you knew Hosea? Would it have more teeth if you actually knew Hosea? What if it was your son? What would you say? Would you grab your son and say, leave her alone? She loves to wander. Here she is using your gifts, the gifts you bestow upon her, she's using them to please others. Why do you keep taking her back? Why do you love her? Why are you so committed to her? Why are you so committed to this broken marriage? You know, it's just not personal to us a lot of times, but it was definitely personal to Hosea. And it was personal to God. And this book is not really about Hosea, it's about God. Let's not forget this. So let's begin in chapter 2. I'll read 1 through 13. Say to your brothers, you are my people. And to your sisters, you have received mercy. Plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife. And I'm not her husband. That she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. Lest I strip her naked and make her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and make her like a parched land, and kill her with thirst. Upon her children also I will have no mercy, because they are children of whoredom. For their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Therefore I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build up a wall against her so that she cannot find her path. Then she shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. She shall seek them, but not find them. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore I will take back my grain in its time, and my wine in its season, and I will take away my wool and my flax, which were to cover her nakedness. Now I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall rescue her out of my hand. And I will put an end to all her mirth, her feast, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her appointed feasts. And I will lay waste her vines and her figs, on which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall devour them. And I will punish her for the feast of the Baals, when she burned offerings to them, and adorned herself with rings and jewelry, and went after other lovers, and forgot me, declares the Lord. So we see from verses 1 through 13, without question, it's the Lord speaking. That's actually summed up in this monologue. At the end of verse 13, it says, declares the Lord. This is the Lord speaking here. It isn't Hosea speaking to his children. This is the Lord speaking to the nation of Israel as a whole. And a few more hints that kind of drive home that fact are in verse 1 of chapter 2, where it says, say to your brothers and say to your sisters, plural and plural. If we were to read all of chapter 1, we would notice that Hosea had two sons and one daughter, not sisters, plural. So it really isn't speaking of Hosea's wife and children. It must be speaking to a broader audience. Now we have the Lord speaking to the nation of Israel and the children of Israel. Apostate Israel as a whole will be viewed as the mother. Should be viewed as Gomer here. And the children here are being viewed as individual members of that nation. So now the conditions in Hosea's life are going to illustrate the relationship between God and his people. You know, Hosea taking that wife of whoredom and having children of whoredom, now that's starting to illustrate what God is trying to teach them. And he says in verse 1, say to your brothers, say to your brothers, that's the Hebrew word ami. You know, earlier it referred to them as lo ami, when it says they are not my people. Here, the lo, that negative prefix is removed. Say to my people. And to your sisters who have received no mercy. You know, that lo ramah, that is now ramah. Say to those who have received mercy. So here's what's being said, if I could get this out. Let's read it this way. What it's saying is, say to your brothers, those who are my people, and to your sisters, those who have received mercy, plead with your mother. The Lord here is speaking to a remnant, those who are saved in Israel, and he's telling them to plead with the nation as a whole, to plead with apostate Israel, to plead with the nation. Plead with them. This word could be translated contend or rebuke. They are to rebuke their mother. They are to rebuke the nation of Israel for rebelling and apostatizing against God who had been so good to them. And God is almost like he's saying, don't contend with me. as if I'm being unfair. Plead your case against your mother. She's not my wife. I'm not her husband. We have no relationship. There's just nothing there. Tell her in verse 2, plead with her that she may put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. Plead with her to put those things away, to put those things behind her. And there actually may be another layer to this. And the NIV actually picks up on it. The NIV translates it this way. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face. You see, in this day, it was common for a harlot to paint their face. The NLT translates it this way. Tell her to remove the prostitute's makeup from her face and the clothing that exposes her breast. Not only is she playing the part, she's dressing the part. Plead with her. Tell her to put those things away, lest or else I will strip her naked and make her as in the day she was born. You see, this incredible compassion that God has for His people here, at the same time, He is serious about this relationship. And He's almost like, you want to lay bare? You want to lay naked in front of men, strangers, lovers? Fine. I will strip you naked as in the day before when you were born. I will make you like a wilderness, like a parched land. I will kill her with thirst. And upon her children, I will have no mercy because they are children of whoredom. Your children who follow in your footsteps will suffer the same fate. And why wouldn't they? These children are just like their mother. Constantly on the look, constantly on the prowl. We see in verse 5 something that's just completely uncommon. For their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers. She doesn't even wait to be pursued, to be enticed, to be lured away. She's actively pursuing other gods, actively pursuing other lovers. This isn't just a rash lapse in judgment. Not that that would make it fine, but this isn't just a lapse in judgment. This is, in Hebrew, it expresses a settled determination. She had made up her mind. She was going after other lovers to get what she wanted. She had painted her face up and she was on the prowl. And she's going after them. Why? For, this is verse 5, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread, my water, my wool, my flax, my oil, and my drink. These are what she considered on down in verse 12. These are my wages, which my lover has given me. She earned this. But the Lord had said back up in verse 8, she didn't know it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, the oil, the silver, the gold. I have provided for her every need. And yet she credits everything to her work, her wages, or even her lovers. So making it personal, why do we go after other gods? Is God not interesting? Oh no, He's interesting. Is He not powerful? He's all powerful. Is He not loving? He's the embodiment of love. We go after other gods for the same reason Gomer does, to get what we want when we want it. The same reason you may see a child in a split household want to go live with daddy, because daddy gives him everything he wants. I want to go live with my mom. My mom gives me everything I want. For the same reason, most kids want to go to their grandparents, right? Because grandma always gives them what they want. You see, we tend to run to situations where we get what we want. And we all want the blessings of God. People want the blessings of God. They just don't want God. You can take the most corrupt politician in America today, and he would stand before a camera and he would say, "God bless America." You see, people want to be blessed by God. What it is, I'll take the blessings, but you keep your God. People want to become Christians oftentimes for the blessings, just to get something from it. Watch out, because that's in your heart too. I can promise you that. And it's manifested, it's on stage, it's on display in the modern prosperity gospel. You name it, you claim it, seek it, get it. It's yours. It's a miracle in your mouth, right? Although Isaiah says, "Woe to me, for I'm a man of unclean lips and dwell amidst the people of unclean lips." Isaiah didn't see it that way. But many people are quick to run to church, Christianity, to God, to get things. If they think they can get something out of it, they'll do it. We even could read this back in Genesis. You know the story of Shechem. You know, as you have Abraham, as you have Jacob and his 12 sons and his daughter, as they're going, as they're leaving their uncle Laban and they're heading into back to the promised land, they stop in a little town called Shechem. And that's where Dinah, their daughter, is raped. And the men are furious about this. The sons are furious about this. So the men of Shechem come and they say, "You know, could we have your daughters? We would love to have your daughters as our wives." They said, "No, we will not do this unclean thing unless you're circumcised." What did the men of Shechem do? They get circumcised. You see, they were willing to get circumcised and follow the God of Jacob if they could get something out of it. The same reason people today may join a church, get baptized, if they feel like they'll get something out of it. She's chasing other gods because she wants something. We're no different. But we have to know God is the giver of all gifts, and what you receive from God is for your benefit and His glory. And here's the thing, what He withholds from you is still for your benefit and His glory. That's what we get in verse 7. Or verse 6. "Therefore, I will hedge up her way with thorns. I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. She shall seek them, but not find them. Then she will say, 'I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now.'" God was protecting her from self-destruction. He was restraining her from her sin. And it's oftentimes in this hard time is when it actually causes us to cry out to God. It causes us to seek God when things are not, we're not getting what we want. You know, it's in the story of the people of Israel in Egypt. We're told that when they were in Egypt, that they sat by pots of meat and ate bread until they were full. They're reminiscent of this in Numbers 11 as they're wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. They say, "Hey, we remember when the fish we ate in Egypt cost us nothing. We had cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. We could eat till we were full. Things were good in Egypt until there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And this Pharaoh made life hard on these people. And it's in the midst of that oppression that the people cry out to God. Right? And it's not until they cry out to God that he pulls them out of Egypt. You know, you see this cycle over and over in Judges. You know, the people just wander off into sin or actually run off into sin. And when the Lord sends judgment and oppression upon them is when they cry out to God. It's no different here. It's not until some things are taken away that it drives them to seek God. And she says at the end of verse 7, then she will say, I will go and return to my first husband. For it was better for me then than now. You know, this has the same tone, really, of the prodigal son. You know, when he's off living amongst the swine, he goes, I'll return to my father. For it was better for me then than now. But here, it just really seems as if it's in pretense only. You know, what it seems like she's saying is there's really just no better choice. It's just the best option. I'll just go back to the Lord. It's better for me then than it is now. And if we watch this play out through the Old Testament, when the nation returns to Jerusalem after its Babylonian captivity, many remained behind. But those that did return, they returned in pretense only. Their hearts were not drawn back to God. They get back and they're more concerned with building their own houses than they are the temple of the Lord. They're not drawn back to God. They just think that's where they'll receive the blessings. But verse 8, and she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, the oil, who lavished on her silver and gold. So as I read this, I was like, how can she not know? How can Israel not know? God called Abraham out of idolatry. He created a nation from one man, brought them up out of Egypt, led them through the wilderness. Their shoes and clothes didn't wear out. Planted them in the land, provided for them. How can they not know? They know. This isn't ignorance. This is rebellion. They know, they just don't consider. They never take notice. The NIV actually translates it that way. She has not acknowledged that it was I who gave her the grain. The NET. She has refused to acknowledge that I was the one who gave her the grain. She knew. She just refused to acknowledge that it was God. New Testament, fast forward, Romans 1, what's Paul saying there? That although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God, and they did not give Him thanks. They refused to acknowledge that these gifts come from God. They choose to think they earned them. They choose to think those gifts come from her lovers. And she takes these gifts and she uses them for Baal. That's what it says at the end of verse 8. I lavished on her silver and gold, and she used it for Baal. They took all these blessings from God, and they used them to pleasure other lovers. Used them in the service of Baal worship. We actually flip over to chapter 8. You see exactly what they were doing. Chapter 8 of the book of Hosea, verse 4. They're taking the silver and gold, and they made kings. But not through me. They set up princes, but I knew not. With their silver and gold, they made idols for their own destruction. That's exactly what he was saying back here. They took the silver and gold, and they created these idols, these Baals, and they worshiped them. Gods, lovers. Let's reflect back today. Do you use possibly, is it a possibility that you use a God-given gift to serve the flesh? To serve yourself? To serve others? Maybe you have a great voice. Maybe God's given you a great voice that He gave you to use to glorify Him and to honor Him with that voice. And many take that talent and they turn it and they use it solely to please the flesh, solely to pursue the world. Not to honor God, not to glorify God, with the gift that He's given you. So the challenge is, are we guilty of not using our gifts in the service of God? Are we guilty of times of not using the gifts God's bestowed upon us to glorify Him? Instead, we use those gifts to go after other lovers, to pursue passions of our own heart. Verse 9, therefore I will take back my grain in this time and my wine in this season. And I will take away my wool and my flax, which were used to cover her lewdness. You remember back up in verse 5? Back in verse 5, she considered all these things hers. My bread, my water, my wool, my flax, my oil, my drink. Here, notice the personal pronouns of what God's saying in verse 9. My grain. Right? My wine, my wool, my flax. You didn't earn that. Your other lovers didn't give you that. The God of success didn't provide that for you. God did. And then he goes right here and he says, I will take back my grain in its season, in its time, my wine in its season. That's two different seasons, by the way. It's not like there was just a little short drought for 2 months. This is a lengthy drought. This is judgment. This is punishment from God. God's withholding the much needed rain they needed for survival. You know, we tend to be a little bit spoiled. When we see a dry season, it really doesn't impact us. We get impacted when we go to the grocery store. Maybe the food costs a little more than it did. But not in this day. This day it was direct. You know, they had a direct effect of a drought. We're usually only affected through monetary means at a Piggly Wiggly or something. You know, our blessings have actually blinded us from our dependency on God. And I worry about that often. Verse 10. I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall rescue her out of my hand. That's exactly what he had said he would do back up in verse 3. He said, I will strip her naked. Here he's going to uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. No one's able to rescue them out of her hand. That's true. We can read this going through the Old Testament. No one's able to save Israel. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, no matter who they ran to for help, whether it be Egypt, Egypt wasn't able to help them. No one was able to rescue them from the hand of God. Verse 11. And just notice what he refers to all these worship services. They're hers. And I will put an end to all her mirth, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, all her appointed feasts. So what could this be referring to? It could be referring to the pagan feast days in the northern kingdom. You know, they were in the northern kingdom. They had these golden calves set up. They had their own feast days, their own holy days. Maybe that's what it's referring to. Or it simply could be referring to the fact that Israel's worship was man-centered. It was all about them. It was intended solely and purposed. It was constructed purposely to satisfy their own itching ears. Maybe that's what he's speaking of there. Because the worship of God, even the worship they had in the book of Amos, was a burden, right? When will this be over? Isn't that what they were saying in Amos 8? When will the Sabbath be over so we can go back to selling grain? The whole thing was a burden and a drag. Verses 12 and 13. And I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, which he said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall devour them. and I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she burned offerings to them and adorned herself with a ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares the Lord. She will be punished for her infidelity, forgetting and ignoring God as a source of all her blessings. Instead, she praises God, she praises lovers for them, worshiping the Baals. This doesn't go unnoticed by God, and He will punish her for this iniquity. So just a quick sum up of 1 through 13, because it's easy as we read this and we get the national picture that God's painting, but sometimes we forget the real life situation that depicted this whole relationship. That was Hosea and Gomer. And so despite Gomer's constant unfaithfulness, chasing these other lovers, using the very gifts given to her by Hosea to entice and satisfy other lovers, placing a hedge around her, trying to restrain her and prevent her from sin, to no avail, she could not be restrained. To that, as an onlooker, we would scream, "Leave her alone. You deserve better." Yet Hosea loves her. Hosea will actually march down to her lover's house and redeem her while she's really still in the act, which mirrors the truth in Romans. While we were yet still in our sins, God died for us. While she was still in the act, Hosea is going to go and buy her back. He's going to speak tenderly to her. He's going to woo her, allure her. And she's so unfaithful. So does she deserve it? No. And neither do you. I don't know, guys. If this book of Hosea doesn't grip your heart, then that's on me. I'm not doing my job. We'll read 14 through 23. "Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And there I will give her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my Baal. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. And I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven and the creeping things on the ground. I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. And I will make you lie down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in the righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. And in that day I will answer, declares the Lord. I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. And the earth shall answer the grain, the wine, the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel. And I will sow her for myself in the land. And I will have mercy on no mercy. And I will say to not my people, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God." So we're going to see quickly, we move from judgment to promise. From judgment to restoration. Remember, back up in verse 13, she's being judged because she went after other gods and forgot Yahweh. But verse 14 says, "Therefore, nevertheless," that can be translated, "nevertheless, I will still go and speak tenderly to her. I will still go and allure her and woo her back." You see, restoration is clearly in focus here. And this, notice this restoration has many material blessings associated with it. In verse 15, we read vineyards. Verse 18, it speaks of the animal kingdom. Verse 18, it also speaks of the absence of war. Verse 22, it speaks of the grain, the wine, and the oil. Verse 23, So you see, this restoration we're reading here is not to be spiritualized. It's not symbolic. No one reading this book, no one hearing this, ever thought the curses and the judgments were spiritual. When God said, "I will cast you away," that wasn't spiritual. They were going to be sent away into a foreign nation, to a people of foreign speech. That wasn't symbolic. That was literal. You see, it's only when you enter into this passage here with preconceived ideas that, or a system to prove, that you walk away with that kind of understanding. The judgments, we can read about them. They were actual, they were physical, they were brutal, they were horrific. Just read about them in the book of Kings and Chronicles. Those judgments that came upon the nation of Israel, they are without question. Scripture teaches that. History teaches that. They were real, physical, actual judgments. Nothing symbolic about them. So I guess I say all that to kind of warn you up front from reading too much into the blessing side of this. I don't want you to read the church into all the Old Testament blessings as if the church has replaced Israel, because that's not the case. That is either outright replacement theology, or at the very least, it's subtle replacement. A man by the name of Charles Feinberg traveled to Jerusalem and was preaching to a Jewish audience over there, and he happened to be following a sermon from an amillennial pastor. And that amillennial pastor pretty much told them that all the blessings associated in the Old Testament that were given to Israel were to the church. So you have Feinberg comes up after that, and he really just apologized. He said, "Hey, look, I'm come here on behalf of American Christianity to apologize. I'm sorry that you, national Israel, felt the hand of God. You felt the punishment and judgment from God for disobedience. And yet you were received none of the promises." You see, replacement theology has Israel receiving all the curses, none of the blessings. But the Lord here, through Hosea, although he's warned them, he lovingly warned them over and over and over. This wasn't the first prophet to the nation of Israel. This wasn't the first prophet to the northern kingdom. He's still faithful to his covenant. He's still faithful to his commitment. So Hosea ends this with hope and anticipation. Anticipation that God will not forsake his people. He will speak to her. He will speak to Israel. He will woo her. He will allure her. And it says in verse 16 that she will call me my husband and no longer call me my Baal. This doesn't sound to me anything like verse 7 where I'm just going to go back to my first husband. It was better for me then than now. No, here the Lord is calling her out. He's wooing her. And she calls him my husband. This is Israel looking on him whom they've pierced. Weeping as one weeps for an only child. This is Israel. This is repentant Israel crying out to God. Repenting, weeping, knowing that they had struck the Son of God. They had pierced God in the flesh. Then the very next verse in Zechariah 12 or Zechariah 13 there says, "Then a fountain will be opened on the house of Israel to cleanse them from their sin and uncleanness." So you see, they look upon him whom they've pierced. That's Jesus Christ. And they will mourn as one mourns for their only child. They realize they rejected their Messiah. Then a fountain will be opened. It will cleanse them from their sin. It will cleanse them from their uncleanness. This relationship, this my husband, no longer calling me my Baal, is future. my husband, no longer calling me my Baal, not just another god. And there's another play on words here in the Hebrew. It could actually be translated as my master. You will call me my husband and no longer call me my master. That's how the NET actually translates it. The point is, this isn't going to be a master-slave relationship. It rings near to what Jesus told the people in John 15. No longer will I call you slaves. For a slave does not know what his master is doing. But I've called you friends. It's no wonder reading this. It's no wonder to me the Apostle Paul rejects the idea that God is through with the nation of Israel. That's really what he says in Romans 11. He very well may have had Hosea in mind when he said that. Because this reunion that we see pictured here in Hosea, it was unlike anything we've ever seen. The animal kingdom that we read here, verse 18, I will make for them a covenant with the beast of the field, the birds of the heaven, creeping things on the ground. Reminds you of Romans 8 when it says all of creation groans, eagerly waiting to be set free, right? Eagerly waiting to be free from that bondage. No more wars. I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. You will lie down in safety. The earth and all its produce will be lifted. The curse will be lifted. This is almost like the Eden. This is like we're right back in Eden here where it says, I will answer, this is verse 21, I will answer the heavens, they shall answer the earth. The earth shall answer the grain, the wine, the oil. All this produce, all this fruit no longer comes by the sweat of your brow with thorns and thistles and toil. No more. Not in that day. Verse 21, in that day, verse 16, in that day, in that great day, when Israel looks upon me, whom they've pierced, mourns as one mourns for an only child, God will restore them back. Bring back the times of restoration spoken of in Acts 3. In that day, the heavens, the earth, the ground, the beast, all will be in perfect submission to the true and better Adam, Jesus. He will restore all things. And as I stated before, we read these verses containing the restoration. These promises belong to Israel. We're told that in Romans 9. They are Israelites. To them belong the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. So the question is, how do we fit in? We, as Gentiles, we are wild olive branches that have been grafted in. We are partakers of this new covenant through Jesus Christ. You know, we're no better than these Israelites. We're no more deserving than they are. And as you see what God does for His people, what God does for us, there isn't another little g God among all the pagans that would act in the same manner that God does. To take a people who can be described as a bunch of arrogant, ungrateful, hell-deserving sinners. Hell-deserving children of whoredom, according to Hosea. And He would send His Son to them. To live for them, to die for them. His Son would give His life for them so that they could have a relationship with Him. It's mind-blowing. That He would be so faithful to His commitment, so faithful to these people, that He would take them back. That's looking at them. But look at us. That He's so merciful, so loving, that He would even receive us at all. Praise God that He sent His Son, and it's through Him we can be reconciled to God. But while we were still sinners, He died for us. That's just incredible. I'm blown away by this book. I know we got several more chapters of it, so we'll see where it takes us.